Continuing our road trip through the 66 books of the Bible, we've called Route 66, taking big picture view of the scriptures and trying to come away with a good understanding of major overarching themes. And I've been encouraged and challenged as we move through the series. I hope you have as well. We're going to be in Judges today, which is a book that I think really uniquely resonates with our situation. You read Judges and it just makes you tired. You look at the brokenness of the world, the dysfunction, propensity towards sin, propensity towards being entangled within our culture, and I think it really resonates with kind of my feeling in our current culture and where we're at. And so I think it's going to be one that uniquely points us to Christ, and we're gonna find some kindred spirits here in the book of Judges. Sometimes these are called the books of history. So we had the books of the law, which is the little orange stack there on the top left shelf. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Foundational books unpack for us the creation of the universe, the creation of humanity. We come to understand God's design for creating us, the unique role that we play in the created order because we've been created in the image of God. We are God's. God's the owner. We're his managers. We've been charged with overseeing his creation. We're also introduced there in those opening books to the advent of sin, the fall of humanity into sin and all of its destructive consequences. And we're also introduced to God's redemptive plan. It's inaugurated here in these early books of the Bible. God sets out to work a plan through Abraham and his descendants through which he will bring blessing to all the nations of the earth. So that's all in those books of the law, those foundational books, and now we're moving into what sometimes, again, is called the books of history, Joshua, today Judges. The Hebrew understanding of the Hebrew scriptures is a little bit different. So Jewish people sort of order their Bibles a little differently. They see three main groupings. Sometimes it's referred to as the Tanakh. So each of those main consonants there, the T and the N and the K, represent the major groupings of the Hebrew Bible. So the Torah, that's the T, that's the law, that's what we've been considering, those first five books of the Bible. And then the Nevi'im, which is the prophets, that's what we're now into. And then the Ketuvim, which is the writings, or maybe the poetry, Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon. Even the book of Ruth, we're going to be considering next week, is actually considered part of the writings in the Jewish Bible. So, but anyways, we're in the Nevi'im. We've moved into a new section here, the ministry of the prophets. Judges itself can be broken up or thought about in some main sections. I'm going to suggest a three-part outline today. Chapters 1 and 2 lay the groundwork, really capture the transition from Joshua, who led the people into the promised land, but who has now died. And so where do we go from here, right? And it's really, we realize that it's a period of decline for the nation. And then chapters 3 through 16 really give, it's kind of the meat of the book. It gives us the history of these 400 years and introduces us to the individuals or the judges who God used to deliver his people. And then chapter 17 through 21 at the end includes a summary, sort of an assessment of where Israel is at. Spoiler alert, it's pretty dark. Okay, and it leaves us kind of hanging. There's not a happy ending, as it were. And I think in a unique way, it again points us to Christ. So first of all, decline, the section of decline, the introductory portion of the book. If you have a copy of God's Word with you, I invite you to join me here in the book of Judges. And here at the outset, we have a quandary. Here's your vocab word of the day, right? There's a question. There's a riddle. There's something uncertain that marks the beginning of the book of Judges. It says here in chapter 1, verse 1, after the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, "Who of us is to go up first to fight against the Canaanites? Who is going to take the lead? Where do we go from here?" They had experienced initial victory and had gained possession of the majority of the land. Each of the 12 tribes had received at least an initial portion of their inheritance of land within the promised land, but there was much additional work to be done. In God's providence, in His wisdom, God had determined that they were to take the land, that they were to be given the land little by little. So when they first came into the land, they conquered Jericho, and that was pretty cataclysmic, right? It was just a huge victory. The walls were brought down, but that was not going to be typical of how this was going to unfold. It was going to take place little by little. The people would have to continue to trust God over time. They would have to show courage and persistence and fortitude to finish the task. So initial victories have been won. All the exciting stuff has happened. Now it's the grind. Now it's the ongoing obedience that is being called for here. Here at the outset in Judges, we are reminded about the wickedness of the Canaanites. And Craig brought this up last week in looking at the book of Joshua. We have to wrestle with it. Israel is being asked, the people of Israel are being asked to come in and drive out, to destroy the Canaanites. It seems to us like an act of genocide, right? It certainly seems to be very cruel. But we are reminded again here that God is not just showing favoritism towards them or towards Israel, and these are wicked people. Matter of fact, back in Genesis, God told Abraham, "I'm not going to give you this land yet because their wickedness is not yet complete. Like, I'm not prepared yet to bring judgment against them. I'm going to give them a little more time." And God gave them over 400 more years. But finally, God's patience had run out, and He brings judgment against the Canaanites, and He uses His people as instruments of judgment. But I think we get a glimpse of that here in Judges 1, verse 4. Judah, the tribe of Judah, is identified as the ones who are going to take the lead. It says, "When Judah attacked, the Lord gave the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hands, and they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. It was there that they found Adonai Bezek," literally the Lord of Bezek or the King of Bezek, "and fought against him, putting to rout the Canaanites and Perizzites. Adonai Bezek fled, but they chased him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes." Seems a little excessive, doesn't it? My kids' dinner last night said, "We're in Judges tomorrow. Isn't that one of the boring books?" And I said, and then they caught themselves like, "Oh no, it's actually a this is not the book of Leviticus with just lists about sacrifices and such. There's a lot of action, and we get into it right away. They're cutting off thumbs and big toes of conquered kings. And you say, why would they do that? Was that really necessary? Look at verse 7. "Then Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off have picked up scraps under my table. Now God has paid me back for what I did to them." They brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. Out of the mouth of this pagan king, we get our perspective, don't we? These kings were brutal and violent, and even this king of Bezek recognizes that now God is holding me to account. He is giving me what I deserve. So I think this is a really helpful perspective as we think about Israel coming into the promised land and what's really going on here in terms of God's judgment. Caleb is highlighted here. He is one of the men from the tribe of Judah. And it seems fitting that Caleb plays a prominent role here in the conquest. Caleb was one of two spies that brought back a positive report. And so Caleb shows his faith here. He is one that is inspiring the people to continue on and to take the land that God had given them. He had one city in particular that he wanted to see conquered, Kiriath Sefer, and he offered his daughter Aksa in marriage to the warrior who would defeat that city. Seems a little bit crude to us. We feel a bit sorry for Aksa, Caleb's daughter, who is given out as a prize. But we quickly realize that she is no chattel. She is not simply property to be bantered about. She, much like her father Caleb, is a woman of faith and action. Notice what we read about her in chapter 1, verse 14. By the way, Othniel was the lucky guy, the brave warrior who won Aksa's hand in marriage. One day, when she, Aksa, came to Othniel, her husband, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, "What can I do for you?" She replied, "Do me a special favor. Since you have given me land in the Negev, give me also springs of water." So Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. I love this little account. Aksa says to her husband Othniel, "Othniel, go ask my father for property." And apparently Othniel waited about 2 seconds too long, because Aksa gets off her donkey and goes over to talk to her dad herself and says, "You gave me land in the Negev. It's dry, it's parched, it's a desert. I need water. Give me the two springs." And Caleb, I think, had to smile inside and said, "That's my daughter." boldly asking for God's blessing, and he gave her the two springs. One of the threads we see in Judges is the role of courageous women, often standing in stark contrast to passive men. Aksa is just the first in a long line of courageous women here in Judges. So the quandary, who's to go, who's to lead? Well, the tribe of Judah, Caleb, his daughter Aksa, they're some of the ones who help give leadership to Israel in the days after Joshua's death. But then there's what I call capitulation. There's a problem that surfaces here, and it's unpacked for us in verses 19 through 36 here in chapter 1. Let me pick up in verse 27 just to give us a sense here. But Manasseh, this is one of the 12 tribes, Manasseh did not drive out the people of Beit Shan or Tanakh or Dor or Iblim or Megiddo and their surrounding settlements, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. So they couldn't drive them all out right away. No big surprise there. But it says that when Israel did become stronger, they still didn't drive them out. Instead, they subjected them to forced labor. They made them slaves. How convenient, right? Let's profit off their labor. But they didn't do what God asked them to do. They allowed the Canaanites to live among them. And in that sense, they disobeyed the Lord. And the same thing happened with the tribes of Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, Naphtali, the tribes of Joseph. Israel as a nation, not just one tribe, did not obey God's command in this regard. And of course, that brings a consequence. God shows up in chapter 2. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, "I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land I swore to give to your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? And I have also said, I will not drive them out before you. They will become traps for you, and their gods will become snares to you." When the angel of the Lord had spoken these things to all the Israelites, the people wept aloud, and they called that place Bochim. There they offered sacrifices to the Lord. God said, you have not driven them out, and now you will have to live with that choice. I'm going to remove my power. I'm not going to give you my aid in driving them out. These nations will become a source of great grief to you for years to come. Well, as a parent, if your children disobey what you've asked them to do, then you have to craft punishments, don't you? You have to sometimes you have to get kind of creative. Think, what is a fitting punishment for the wrong that they've done? Sometimes you don't have to craft a punishment, do you? Sometimes there's what we would call a natural consequence to their action. And now they simply have to live with the consequences of their choice. This is what God does. As the consummate parent, he says, you made a choice, and now you're going to have to live with those consequences. Another sad feature here at the outset, as the stage is being set here, is what I call the disconnect. Actually, chapter 2, beginning of verse 6, gives a really tight summary. This is your cliff notes right here. If you just read chapter 2, verse 6, through the end of the chapter, you would come away with a pretty good handle on the book of Judges, all right? Well, let's pick up here. Judges 2, 6. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to their own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him, and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. After that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. There's three generations that are spoken of here. There's Joshua's generation. Joshua was part of that adult generation who had come out of Egypt. I mean, he saw the plagues that God performed there in Egypt. He saw the Red Sea parted and God's people cross on dry land. He saw Pharaoh's mighty army destroyed in the Red Sea. And then there was another generation of the elders who outlived Joshua. So that next generation, you'll remember that most of Joshua's generation died in the wilderness, right? Because of their lack of faith. God raised up the next generation. They were the ones then that would enter into the promised land. They saw the Jordan River, the waters of the Jordan River held back. They saw the walls of Jericho fall. And then there's another generation that now comes onto the scene, a third generation. And unthinkably, we're told that this generation did not know the Lord or the things that he had done for Israel. How can that be? Right? And I think at some level, this speaks to a failure in the homes of the people. Failure of parents to convey the faith to the next generation. A sober, I mean, this is a major baton drop here. A disconnect between that second generation and the third generation. By the way, which generation are you? That's a really interesting question. The question posed to me in my college years. I remember speaker putting up three chairs on the platform and saying, which chair are you in, right? You know, this first generation who witnessed all of God's great things, maybe a first generation Christian in your family, and then maybe you grew up as a second generation Christian, and you made a genuine profession of faith and turned to Christ, but your faith was, you were kind of living vicariously through the faith of your parents. It wasn't necessarily your own, and by the time you get to a third generation, they see the duplicity in the second generation. It's not a vital faith. And interesting to think about where you might put yourself on that spectrum. It only takes one generation to drop the baton of faith. And so this is the sobering reality that's happening here as we head into the book of Judges. We're introduced here as well in chapter 2 to a dysfunctional cycle that will repeat itself over and over and over again in the book. And this is essentially that cycle. The people would turn to idolatry. Remember, they have chosen to allow the Canaanites to continue to live among them. And so gradually they're influenced by the Canaanites. They begin to adopt their sexual practices. They adopt the worship of these gods of the surrounding nations, engage in idolatry. And then God brings oppression, judgment, right? He allows those nations to come against them, to discipline them. And then there is deliverance. There's repentance. The people recognize that they have done wrong, that they've sinned. They recognize that they can't extract themselves out of their situation. They can do nothing but cry out to the Lord, and then the Lord brings deliverance. That's where the judges come in. God raises up individuals to help bring them relief. And then they experience blessing. They experience a season of blessing. But before long, they forget God's blessing. They forget their history. They forget the heartache. They forget God's judgment. And they once again engage in idolatry. So this is what's going to be played out here in the book of Judges. There's also a challenge. At the end of chapter 2 and into chapter 3, we get a little view behind the curtain here in terms of what God is seeking to accomplish. Verse 21, chapter 2, verse 21, "I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it, as their ancestors did." So this is the challenge that is extended to Israel. It's one of the reasons why God didn't drive them out all at the same time. God was going to continue to test them to see if they would show themselves to be faithful to him. And the verdict comes in chapter 3, verse 5. Sobering, chilling summary statement here. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. So this is where we've come to, right? The stage is set now for the time of the judges. Consistent pull towards cultural conformity. Israel was prone to it, and so are we. So a season of decline after the passing of Joshua, a generation that didn't know the Lord or the things that he had done for Israel. And that leads us in chapters 3 to 16 into a season of just dysfunction. We see this played out now. Here's the narrative now of the accounts. And there's victories there. God does bring deliverance for his people. God shows his mercy, his covenant faithfulness, even when the people don't deserve it. But in the midst of it all, there's just a growing dysfunction. Things keep getting worse and worse. Everyone's doing what is right in their own eyes. They have completely cast off God's laws and God's instructions. And so we see where that leads them. I should clarify that the judges described here are not what we might think when we use that word. We think of a judge sitting behind a big desk in a courtroom, maybe wearing a black gown, probably with some gray hair, representing wisdom in the gray hair, right? That's not the idea here in the judges. These judges were warriors. They were wielding the sword. They were leading Israel in military campaigns, in revolt against these oppressive nations. So there is some instances where the judges then are also involved in providing some ongoing leadership and maybe arbitrating decisions. But by and large, they are warriors who are bringing about deliverance. There are certainly individuals to be commended for their faith. Matter of fact, Hebrews 11 lists several of these judges, and identifying specifically that aspect of their courage and their faith. God empowered them by his Spirit to do his work. There's a strong theology of the Holy Spirit here. It's not just that these individuals were so great or so ingenious or so strong, but God worked through them, gave them supernatural ability to be able to deliver his people. Having said that, these judges were not good people. They were not godly people. We don't have to make excuses for that or try to sugarcoat their sin. I think it's a part of the point of the book. They, just like the nation as a whole, had engaged in cultural compromise. And so what we're seeing in these leaders is indicative of what was happening in the nation. So I want to just trace five of them. They're probably the most well-known. And want to just talk briefly about what God did, how God used them, but also to highlight some of their sin. These are not perfect leaders by any means. They are lacking in certain qualities here. So here's our handy-dandy map of Israel: Sea of Galilee, the body of water in the north, and the Dead Sea in the south. Obviously, the Mediterranean Sea, the large body of water off to the left. We begin here with Ehud, chapter 3. By the way, if you only have time to read one account, this might be a good one to read this afternoon. It would keep you on the edge of your seat. The problem at this time with Ehud was the Moabites, who had crossed from the east side of the Jordan River over into Israel. They had actually conquered Jericho. And this would have just been a brutal situation for the people of Israel. Moab, the people of Moab, were some historic enemies of Israel. When Israel first came out of Egypt, they were a slave people. They didn't have any weapons. They didn't have any military training. They're wandering about the wilderness with their women and children and the elderly and the disabled. And the people of Moab, the king of Moab, tried to bring down a curse on Israel. He hired Balaam. You remember that whole account. So this would have just been really hard for them to take being under Moabite oppression. I think making it even worse was the fact that Eglon, the king, who we're told was a very fat man, he had set up his summer palace in Jericho. Think of what Jericho was. I mean, it was the first city that God gave them when they entered into the promised land, and it was to be devoted to the Lord. They were not to rebuild or inhabit Jericho. It was God's city. They gave him the first of what they took in that promised land. And so here is Eglon, this fat Moabite king, sitting there sipping pina coladas in Jericho. And Ehud had to, he drew the short straw. He was the one bringing the tribute money to King Eglon, right? This is what it meant. You were subject to Moab, so you had to pay them money every year, bring crops or whatever it was. So he's bringing this. He's just had this encounter with Eglon, and he's going back home. And it seems that the last straw, it says that he passed the stone idols, or at the place of the stone idols. Seems that the Moabites had set up some of their pagan gods or goddesses there along the road. And something snapped in Ehud at that moment. And he said to the rest of the delegation, "Hey, you guys go back, I forgot something." And he goes back. Ehud's a trained warrior. It says that he was left-handed, which is a very interesting word. He was actually right-handed. He had been made to be left-handed. Presumably his parents had tied his right hand behind his back, forced him to become dexterous with his left hand. He had strapped a very small dagger to the inside of his right thigh, a place that they wouldn't tend to look for in a right-hand dominant culture. He made his way in, gained a private audience with Eglon, said, "I have a special message for him," which he did. And he proceeded to thrust this dagger in so that the hilt was completely covered by Eglon's fat belly. Ugh. We might question this is peacetime. There's a lot of manipulation. There's a lot of deceit. We're not saying at all that Ehud's a perfect guy, but God used him to bring deliverance for his people against the Moabites. Then there's Deborah up in the north part of the country. we're told that the Canaanites there had 900 iron chariots. This was the premier cutting-edge military technology of the day. Israel had a big fat zero iron chariots. So this was not a fair fight here. We're actually told earlier on that the Benjaminites were not able to drive out some of the people because they had iron chariots. Here we find Deborah saying, I don't care how many chariots they have. That's land that God's promised to us, and we're going to take it. And exhibited tremendous faith. She appoints a guy by the name of Barak to be the military commander, but Barak is afraid. Barak says, okay, I'll go, Deborah, but only if you go with us. And Deborah says, fine, but just know that the glory is going to go to a woman. And it's exactly how it played out. The Israelites, God gave them a great victory, an unthinkable victory over the Canaanites and all those iron chariots. Sisera, the Canaanite military commander, escapes, runs for his life. He's welcomed into the tent of Jael, a local woman, who says, oh, come in, I'll take care of you. She gives him a warm glass of milk, covers him with a blanket, and then proceeds to drive a tent peg into his skull as he's sleeping. And the glory goes to a woman, just as Deborah had said. God brought about a great deliverance. Then there's Gideon. The arrow here, it's kind of in the central region, but the arrow points south. The problem during Gideon's time was the Midianites. And they were actually from way far south of Israel, but they were a nomadic people. So they're constantly traveling about. And for 7 years, the Midianites had shown up at the time of harvest and decimated Israel, just took all their food, killed all their animals. It's like the raccoons when my grapes get ripe every year. I mean, they don't do anything until the grapes are purple and ripe, and then they just wipe it out in a night. It's crazy. This is what the Midianites did for 7 years. I know how these people felt, right? I mean, think about it. 7 years. They're just kept impoverished because of the Midianites. So God raises up Gideon, who is a bit reluctant, didn't feel particularly capable. God said, that's okay. We're not going to be needing any of your power anyways. It's going to be my power. And God not only defeated the Midianites through Gideon, but also used Gideon to confront the idol worship within Israel. Matter of fact, Gideon's own father had built an altar to Baal in the city center. And he had also constructed a wooden idol, a profane idol to the goddess Asherah, the fertility goddess. It would have been a lewd, graphic idol right there in the middle of the town square. And so God said, first things first, Gideon, we got to deal with that altar and that idol. And I want you to go tear down the altar, and I want you to cut up that idol. And so Gideon did it. Wasn't real popular for the townspeople, or his father for that matter. Matter of fact, he was given another name, the name Jerubbaal, which basically means the enemy of Baal. Gideon took a strong stand for the Lord, and God used Gideon and an army of only 300 men to defeat the Midianites. You remember how God kept whittling down the army, right? They were already vastly outnumbered, but God said, there's too many people. I want it to be evident that I gave you the victory here. So he says, anybody that's afraid, just send them home. And then he goes through the whole thing at the spring. You know, those that get down and drink like a dog, send them home. And those 300 who got down on one knee and cupped the water in their hands, he said, okay, there's my 300 right there. And Gideon trusted the Lord, and God gave them a great victory. But we see Gideon's problem at the end of the account. It says that he collected gold from all the people. They said, oh, Gideon, we want to make you king. And Gideon's like, no, that's all right. Just give me all your gold. And he crafted a costly ephod. It's kind of an odd choice. An ephod was the outer garment, like a vest, that the priest would wear. What is Gideon doing making an ephod? Who does he think he is? But again, everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes, right? Gideon's no exception, and that ephod would become a snare to Gideon and his family. You can read about all of the murder and violence that characterized Gideon's family in his later years. Jephthah. Jephthah was actually part of a group that had their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan River. Remember, some of the tribes were given their inheritance there on that side. He was delivering the people from the Ammonites, and God used him in a great way. But Jephthah had some serious issues, all right? Notice chapter 11, verse 29. Then the Spirit of the Lord came on Jephthah. He crossed Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, "If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." Mistake. Okay? God gives him the victory over the Ammonites. He comes home, and who do you think walks out his door but his only daughter? I don't know what he expected to walk out of his door, like the family chicken or the dog or what, but it's his daughter, and he kills her. He sacrifices her to the Lord. By the way, this part of Israel, the surrounding nations that were living there on the east side of the Jordan, worshipped Molech, Chemosh, these are the gods that they would offer their babies to. A big iron statue with a fire built inside, and they would place their babies on the scalding hands of the idol. And Jephthah, at some level, was influenced by these kinds of pagan thoughts, superstitious thoughts, and actually sacrificed his daughter like the nations around him. Samson. Samson, of course, was coming onto the scene when Israel had been oppressed by the Philistines down along the Mediterranean Sea there for 40 years. And Samson, of course, God raised him up, gave him great strength. We perhaps are most acquainted with his story, but we also know that Samson allowed himself to be led astray by the ungodly Philistine women. He was drawn to the culture of the Philistines. And remember that the Jewish people were kind of the rednecks. They were living in the hill country. They didn't have any technology. They didn't have any iron. There was no iPhones in the Israelite camp. The Philistines had it all. They had the theaters and the latest in technology and iron chariots. And Samson's heart was just constantly drawn. They had makeup down there in the valley. You know, and these women were beautiful, and he's just drawn to the culture of the Philistines. So, again, these judges were used by God, but they were not godly individuals. They had major issues. And even as you look at the map, you realize, too, that they were all kind of regional leaders. They were putting out little pockets of fire here and over here, but there was no cohesive ruler for the nation. Matter of fact, one of the key phrases here in Judges is, at this time, there was no king in Israel. So obviously, the account was compiled at a later time when there was a king in Israel, and they're pointing back to this era where there was no rule of law. That's why I titled this message, Anarchy, right? Everyone was just doing what was right in their own eyes. And even the best of the judges died. And then the country would once again fall under oppression from their enemies. So a cycle, repeated cycle of dysfunction. And then the closes here with a section on depravity in chapter 17 to 21. Two accounts that really illustrate the depths to which Israel had fallen. And again, it's bookended here. In chapter 17 and then at the end of 21, everyone did as they saw fit or what was right in their own eyes. Sanctioned idolatry. We won't look at the accounts here, but an idol is crafted and the guy worships the idol. He appoints one of his sons to be a priest. I mean, what's wrong with this? Everything's wrong with this picture, right? They were not to create any images of God, graven images. God was to be worshipped in Jerusalem, not in some household shrine. Only the sons of Aaron were to be priests. And as you see this play out, eventually the tribe of Dan comes and they actually steal the idol and they kidnap the priest and they appoint him to be the priest over their whole tribe. And so this isn't just happening in one home. It's like widespread sanctioned idolatry, speaking to the religious depravity of the country. And then a horrible scene at the end, probably the worst scene in the book. And I've described a lot of horrible scenes, but chapters 19 through 21, a scene of violence towards neighbor. A woman is raped and killed. And her husband, a Jewish man, cuts up her body into 12 pieces. And he sends a piece of her body to every one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he said, nothing like this has ever happened here in Israel before. What are you going to do about it? The end. Such a pleasant ending to the book, right? No judge. You have the cycles of sin and oppression and judgment and repentance and deliverance. No deliverance now. It just leaves us with this horrible sense of depravity. Leaves us tired and discouraged. Leaves us feeling like we probably do about now. In our own country, in our own time, in our own political landscape, longing for the arrival of a righteous and eternal king. Longing for Jesus to come back and establish his kingdom once and for all. Just a few lessons. We must resist the empty promises of the culture. Constantly this draw to the culture, to their idols, to their values, to their sexual practices. Always thinking, oh, there's something more I'm missing out on, right? This is Samson, you know. Oh, if I just go down and I don't want any of the local women. I want one of these Philistine women. They are so exotic, you know. And thinking that there's something much better out there. And constantly being drawn back to the worship of the gods of the nations. And the result is utter chaos and devastation and violence and injustice and murder. It's a train wreck. God help us to remember that that his laws are right and good. And God shows us in his law how we are meant to flourish. And when we disregard his law, we do so to our own peril. We must maintain a regular discipline of remembering God's salvation. Again, the people would finally get relief. God would send a deliverer. They would repent. And then after a period of time, they would forget. They would forget God's great salvation. They would forget the oppression and the judgment and the discipline that they had endured before, and they would go off the rails again. We must maintain a regular discipline of remembering God's salvation. God raises up and casts down human leaders in order to accomplish his purposes. The Amorites, the Philistines, the Midianites, the Canaanites, they all thought that they were doing their thing and operating in self-interest. In reality, they were only pawns being used by God to accomplish his purposes. What an important lesson for us to remember in our day of political turmoil and angst. God uses difficult circumstances to test our fidelity. God allowed those nations then to remain to see if his people would be faithful to him. By and large, they failed that test. I can't help but think of our own culture. We live in an increasingly secular culture. We can get downright discouraged about that. But these things provide opportunity for us to live distinctly as God's people. There's a test going on here of whether we will remain faithful in the midst of a prevailing culture that has turned against God. It doesn't mean we dress with funny clothes or we're just odd, but it does mean that we have very different, diametrically opposed worldviews and sexual standards and ways of treating one another that are completely separate from that of the culture. Each of these imperfect judges points us ahead to Jesus, the great deliverer. Again, I think there's a sense in which the gospel glimpse here is what isn't here. In the midst of all, where's the great deliverer? And we're left hanging at the end. Jesus fulfills the desperate need for a righteous and eternal king. I'm going to have you stand with me. We're just going to sing the doxology as our closing. And I couldn't help but be mindful of this, working through Judges, just God's grace and his mercy and his blessing, even when his people didn't deserve it. And if we're honest, we're not much different, are we? We're prone to wander, as we've already sung about today. Our hearts are prone to wander. Let's declare again the blessings in praise of the triune God.